Before we had radio, television, or the internet, we had chickens. Lots and lots and lots of chickens. Our domesticated birds came in hundreds of colors, shapes, and sizes, and we kept them in flocks on our family farms in the countryside and in our backyards in the city. Yes, before there was electronic entertainment and supermarket foods, we loved our chickens. And so today we pause in reflection to ask, can we bring our chickens home from the factory?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 630th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Perryopolis who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metroforum.com. But wherever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Ricochet on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Hi there, Michael.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello, everyone.
And Parmley Taft.
Hello.
Folks, a 1906 census of America's cities found each to contain an average of one chicken for every two people. A 1910 survey of the nation's farms found that 88% of all farms kept flocks averaging 80 chickens. In the Great Depression of the 1930s, chickens provided many families with their only stable source of protein-rich foods. As a nation, we were in love with our chickens. But new technologies born in the World War and developed since have allowed us to move our flocks indoors, where the average flock of 80 grew into the average flock of thousands. We consumers have, for the most, forgot about our love affair with the chicken and contentedly shop our way up and down the polished, fluorescent bright aisles of supermarkets to buy organic and free-range foods. But having tasted the real deal, to the extent of actually being raised on it, we pause to ask, can we bring our chickens back home from the factory? Here to help us peck around for an answer today, we have Jennifer Majesi, who is the author of The Joy of Keeping Chickens and the proprietor with the family of the Vermont's Fat Rooster Farm. Jennifer, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Pleasure to have you aboard. So let me, you were a fish and game biologist, right?
I worked for the Department of the Interior as a wildlife biologist, yes.
And what did you do?
I was a refuge manager in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, managing endangered species like the Hawaiian monk seal and the green sea turtle. And then I was a biologist in Maine, doing habitat restoration for birds such as Atlantic puffins and sorts of birds like that.
Wow. And then all of a sudden, you're the proprietor of the Fat Rooster Farm. How did you make that transition?
Well, I've always had chickens. There was a period of time, I think it was 9 years, when I was without chickens, and I sorely missed them.
Did you have them as a kid?
I did. Uh-huh. My father had a farm in Louisiana, and he had chickens and a strawberry farm and beef cows and milk cows. And
so you were around them.
We were. We had chickens as kids, and we had ducks. And
what is it about kids and chickens? My daughter, Kelsey, won the chicken-hugging contest at her grade school.
they just, I think they're endearing to children. They're fluffy. When you hold them, they emit these little cute sounds that the kids can relate to. And they're like stuffed toys. So I think kids like to be able to be around them. They're not as intimidating, say, as a big Rottweiler.
Right.
Yeah.
They're kind of fun. Well, I have some interesting questions for you. You know, there was a time when almost everybody kept chickens, both in the city and in the country. And why were we so close to our chickens way back then? What was it about the chickens, Jennifer?
I think that they were a way of self-sufficiency. They fit really well in the small homestead type equation. You can give them your table scraps. They were able to forage at will and supplement their diet with anything from insects and grasses to small mice. They have allowed people to have a source of eggs and a source of meat, and they also provided fertilizer for vegetable gardens.
So they were really, I think of the stories I've heard from the Great Depression, and one lady I was talking to said that that's all they really had to eat when it got right down to it was eggs and chicken.
Absolutely. I mean, you didn't need large expanses of, say, pasture land or hay to raise cattle or sheep or goats. You needed just, you could raise wheat and give the chicken the chaff, the chicken's chaff or whatever, leftover rotted vegetables from the earth cellar. And they had required a minimum amount of care.
Mm-hmm. It kind of like little piggies, aren't they?
They are.
Because you can feed them the scraps and there you go.
Yeah, except for they don't, in my opinion, they don't smell as much as pigs, and they're not nearly as intimidating.
All right. Okay, fair enough. Now, back when, you know, before there was all of this electronic entertainment and whatnot, there were a lot of chickens in the cities. Like the 1906 census said that for every two people in the city, there was a chicken.
That's true. And, you know, the trend is actually starting to go back toward keeping chickens in urban environments. There are several people, say, in Manhattan that have chickens on their rooftops in their apartment complexes. So it was very common to do that. They don't require a whole bunch of space. And like I said, they're pretty easy to maintain on scraps from your own larder and along with a bunch of grain that you can purchase at a feed store.
Well, chickens were also the first of our domestic farm animals to really be industrialized in that they were the first animal that we brought inside and essentially started raising them in factories, right? What was it about the chicken that made them the first?
Well, I think, again, it's a very easy source of protein to produce.
Mm-hmm.
In the 1940s and 50s, the industry did go from what was traditionally thought of as free range, where birds were actually free ranged on pasture, to industrializing their production in large barns that were climate controlled and had watering devices and feeding devices. And they were able to mass produce this cheap source of protein very efficiently.
Was there something about the chicken's character or intelligence or whatnot that allowed them, you know, allowed for people to set them up in these industrial settings?
I think that they are easy to set up that way. It's a lot easier to set up a chicken barn than, say, a cattle feedlot. They're not as intimidating, as I mentioned earlier. You can't exactly get killed by being run over by a chicken.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole scene probably factored into their industrialization.
And one more quick thing. We're going to take a break here in a couple of minutes, but I wondered about the varieties of chickens. Is it true that you have chickens that lay chocolate-colored eggs?
That is true. There is a breed of chicken from France called the Marans, and the variety I have is Cuckoo Marans, and their eggshells are a deep chocolate brown.
Wow.
And I have chickens that lay almost every color of the rainbow, except perhaps purple. Americana chickens can lay eggs from light green to almost robin eggs blue.
How many varieties of chickens are there?
Well, the American Poultry Association in the United States recognizes 55 breeds, but there are literally hundreds of varieties and breeds of chickens worldwide.
So when we think of chickens, you know, when we think of the white chicken in the cage, that's just one of hundreds.
That's a hybridized breed of chicken that originally came from hybridizing the Plymouth Rock with the Cornish chicken.
Mm-hmm. And the reason it was hybridized?
They were able to grow very efficiently and use convert feed to meat more efficiently than other birds. And they also lost some instincts like becoming broody, which means wanting to sit and hatch out their own eggs.
Which leads me to the question that I'm going to ask you when we get back from the break, which is, do chickens get stupid when we raise them in factories? This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking chickens with Jennifer Jesse, who is the author of The Joy of Keeping Chickens and the proprietor with her family of the Fat Rooster Farm in Vermont, in beautiful Vermont. And of course we have you. If you'd like to talk chickens with Jennifer, pick up your phone and dial us. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. What does happen to the intelligence of chickens when we put them in a factory? Right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, back in 1906, the average American city had one chicken for every two people. In 1910, 88% of the nation's farms had flocks of chickens, averaging 80 chickens apiece. That's a lot of chickens in America. But you know, in the 1940s and beyond, we took all of those chickens and moved them into a factory. And what happened when we moved those chickens into a factory? That's the subject of this segment of the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Jennifer Majesi, who is the author of The Joy of Keeping Chickens. Jennifer, I got this piece on the forums at MetroFarm.com regarding chickens, and it caused me to pause. I'll read a little bit of it here. "My experience indicates that factory chickens are losing the ability to reproduce their kind. I bought 25 straight-run Plymouth White Rocks in 2002. I have butchered maybe 25 since then, and I have more eggs than I can use, but it's been 3 or 4 years since I was able to put any fried chicken on the table. The roosters perform their duty, and the eggs are fertile. The problem is that the hens don't want to hatch the eggs. Of the past 4 years, one hen hatched 6 chicks. I brought in some fresh stock of mixed breeds from a local farm, but even that didn't help." What happens to the intelligence of chickens when we put them in a factory and they forget how to make babies?
Well, and I don't even necessarily think it may be a question of intelligence. Rather, that trait of becoming broody, and that's what the term is called. It's when
broody.
A hen wants to sit on her eggs with the intent to hatch them out. That has been bred out of most commercial varieties of chickens. The reason being is that with egg layers, who are commercial egg layers, the point is for the hen to lay as many eggs as she possibly can without taking a break to become broody and want to sit on those eggs. With the meat birds, the meat varieties, they've selected for birds that really only have an interest in eating grain and becoming big as quickly as possible, market size.
So really, it's how we teach them. It's what we teach them to do then.
Yes, it's what we are selecting for. It's the same thing as any domesticated farm animals. You know, we have bred cows, breeds that primarily produce milk, and then there are breeds that we use for beef.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm often asked to speak to school students and whatnot about food. And I came up with a little demonstration about the value of food. So what I do is I go to the farmer's market and I buy some eggs. And then I go to the supermarket and buy some eggs. And I take one of each to the class, and I put these eggs in front of the students on a little saucer, and I say, can you tell the difference? And, of course, you know, you're looking at an egg is an egg, right? But it's not.
No, it's not, because typically the eggs that you would get at a farmer's market have come from small farms,
mm-hmm.
who many of these people raise their birds in true free range, where the birds have access to sunlight and soil.
And bugs.
And bugs.
And grasses.
And grass.
And
all of that.
Seeds.
Right. All of that leads to an egg that's rich in omega-3 fatty acids and other trace minerals and vitamins.
And then whereas the factory farmed egg, I'm sure that they have economists metering out exactly how much food to feed the chicken so the chicken produces an egg, but not a millicent more.
Right, and the other thing about feeding chickens feed that has been commercialized is that their entire digestive system works differently to break that food down into eggs or meat, and it's passed on to the product. The commercial factories sometimes add something which makes the intestinal wall of the meat birds thinner so they can absorb more nutrients, but that also leads to problems with absorption of bacteria, and so salmonella can be more prevalent in these commercial breeds and products.
Because the intestinal wall is so thin that the
bacteria can pass through, and all in the name of absorbing more mm-hmm. protein and nutrients to grow more quickly and more efficiently.
So I kind of go through this little presentation with school kids with these two eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the kids are always looking at the eggs trying to figure out which is which. But then I crack them open, and I have them come up, and I look, and have them look, and have them point out which is which. And you know what? They can do it.
Yeah.
They can actually look at the yolk, and they can see that the yolk is of the free-range chicken, is rich in color, and it stands up.
Yeah.
It has body. It has, whereas the factory farmed yolk is pale in color, and it lays flat and splatters out. And furthermore, the egg shell has thickness from the free-range chicken, whereas the shell of the factory egg is as thin as it possibly can be and still ship.
Right.
And so the kids can almost always look at these eggs and see which is which. So when we go to buy our eggs, there really is a difference, isn't there?
There's a huge difference. The other thing is some of those eggs can be up to 3 months old that are in the stores. And if you float them in a glass of water, a lot of times they'll tip on end so that the fat end of the egg is sitting upright in the glass of water, whereas a free-range egg that is fresh laid will sink right to the bottom.
Wow. Now, one of the other comments in the forums at metrofarm.com talked about how people who shop at big supermarkets like Walmart don't buy free-range chickens or chickens raised by a neighbor because they're somehow afraid of them. Do you find that to be true?
I think that's a pretty big generalization. It might be that people who have the necessity to shop at Walmart are just doing so out of the necessity to a budget.
Mm-hmm.
But there are all sorts of creative ways to get consumers to buy your free-range eggs. You could barter some sort of service to them. Maybe they don't have the money to purchase your eggs, which clearly are going to cost a little bit more to produce than the Walmart eggs, but maybe they know how to run a weed whacker and they can weed whack around your chicken yard.
Let me ask you this. Do you think there really is such a thing as cheap eggs?
Well, there are cheap eggs, but I don't think that they... I don't think if you factor in all the economics behind it, they aren't cheap.
Okay. Just one of my... The Michael Olson's third law of the food chain is cheap food isn't.
Right.
And I just wanted to make sure that there was some agreement there. Then, cool. So you actually are able to sell your chocolate-covered eggs?
Yes. It took us a little bit of time to market them because there is a demographic. In the Northeast, brown eggs are local eggs, and local eggs are fresher.
Right.
So people really had an aversion to white eggs, and certainly they weren't very willing to try green eggs. But then if you open up the cartons and you showed all of the different colors, white, green, chocolate, the kids get really excited, and they want their moms to buy those eggs. And there's the whole green eggs and ham story.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden, it's a marketing tool.
So it becomes an asset instead of a liability if you sell to the kids.
Right.
Huh. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking chickens today. You know, at one time, we had a lot of chickens here in the United States, in the cities and the country. But we got technologically proficient and shipped them all off to the factory. And today we're asking, can we bring our chickens home from the factory again? With us today, we have Jennifer Majesi, who is the author of The Joy of Keeping Chickens, also the proprietor with her family of Fat Rooster Farm in Vermont, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1980. Right back. Please do stay tuned. Well, I don't know about you, but I remember raising chickens with my grandparents. I remember them running around the barnyard. I remember butchering them. I remember chopping their heads off and watching them hop around. And I remember plucking their feathers. And I remember Sunday fried chicken dinners. And I remember how delicious those chickens were. And so we'll get a little nostalgic every once in a while and wonder if it's possible for us to bring those chickens back from the factory from whence we put them some decades ago. We stashed all of our chickens in the factories, and so today we're wondering if we can bring them home again. And we're asking Jennifer Majesi, who is the author of The Joy of Keeping Chickens and the proprietor of the Fat Rooster. Tell us about the Fat Rooster Farm. It sounds like fun to me.
Well, Fat Rooster Farm is in Royalton, Vermont, and it borders the White River on one side and some forest on the other. It's about 20 acres, and we have everything from beef cows to sheep to chickens and turkeys and guinea hens, even pigs.
So you've got the whole animal farm, don't you?
Yeah, it's pretty diverse. We also grow about 2 acres of vegetables, and we specialize in heirloom varieties of tomatoes.
Wow. Well, let me ask you, Jennifer, is it possible to bring chickens home from the factory again, or have we gone so far down the road of technology that we're stuck there?
I think there are several varieties of chickens still out there, and there are several hatcheries that could provide people with these chickens to raise in their own farms or homesteads, however small a scale it may be.
What about the city?
Well, there are also opportunities in the city. There's something called CSA, which is Community Supported Agriculture, mm-hmm. where people can actually give farmers a portion of money, and then they in turn receive anything from vegetables to eggs to meat to milk.
And there's one right up the road from us here, too. They're everywhere now. What about, let's go to the phones and bring some folks in and who have some ideas with respect to talking about bringing our chickens back. First, let's go to Judith McCrary. Judith, welcome to The Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. I'm enjoying the show.
Well, thank you very much. Where are you?
I'm in Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas. Well, welcome aboard. And you brought up something that many people brought up when I talked about the notion of bringing chickens back from the factory, and that's something called NAIS. What is that?
It's the National Animal Identification System, and this was a plan that was developed in large part by these factory farms in conjunction with federal agencies. And it would require anyone who owns even one livestock or poultry, and that's right down to a single chicken, to register their property with the government, tag each animal, and then report their movements to a database within 24 hours.
So for somebody like Jennifer Majesi and her family who have 20 acres and a whole bunch of different kinds of animals?
We're talking about a paperwork nightmare and something that's incredibly expensive. For most of the animals, they're talking about electronic ID. For chickens, they've gotten creative, and I've had conversations with USDA officials who clearly don't understand how chickens behave when they're not, you know, in a factory farm and caged and de-beaked.
Jennifer?
Yes.
NAIS.
Yes, it is a scary legislation. I just don't think that we should back down and let us our entire system of agriculture be taken over by this institution. Remember the Boston Tea Party? We rebelled against that. That's absurd tax as well.
There seems to be a few of those tea parties going around these days.
It's very scary to think of that much government control, and there are lots of people against it and lots of people speaking out against it.
So essentially for somebody like you who has a small farm with lots of different animals, what NAIS would require you to do would be to establish an official license plate for every animal.
Correct.
Right?
And all in the name of food safety, because they feel that the real threat to food safety is we small farmers. And in fact, that's just absurd, because the way that we've concentrated our processing and distribution centers, you can see
right.
how many problems we've had in the recent past.
Well, you know, a couple weeks ago we did a program on House Resolution 875,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of going down the same road here. In the name of food safety, the government is going to take over the entire food chain and superintend everything. And I have a sneaking or a feeling like that NAIS is kind of a precursor or an addendum or something like this to 875. But I don't think the problem is ever with local agriculture, because local agriculture essentially regulates itself. If Jennifer were to run around selling bad eggs to her neighbors, well, the whole neighborhood is going to know about it within
right.
a few moments' time, and the problem would be taken care of before it ever gets out of hand. But the problem always seems to be in these giant processing and packaging and shipping facilities. And the farther you are from the source of your food, the more problems you're going to have. So that seems to be the place where the government should be sticking its nose in, and not in local agriculture.
I agree. But then again, there are very powerful lobbyists in those industries. So,
well, what are they trying to do? Are they just trying to get rid of their competition, which
I
is
think,
you?
I think they do view we small farmers as competition. Here in our own state of Vermont, it took us over 10 years to pass a piece of legislation where we were able to market chickens that had not been processed in a federally inspected facility. And it was a hard thing to do, but we finally got it passed. People just trust me to sell them chicken that's been raised humanely and cleanly over the stuff that you would buy in the supermarket.
Judith, do you have a sense that this NAIS and the HR 875 are attempts by industry to get rid of you?
That's one of the factors. I mean, it's an interesting mix of things that have gone on. One is a lot of it is about the export market, because that's actually where a lot of the big companies make a lot of money. It's very high profit. And so there's this push to get these international standards that make it easy for them to export. And then, frankly, what they do is they import cheap food from other countries.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to label it. They try avoiding country of origin labeling, and they export American food elsewhere at a premium. You know, you also have the technology companies. You know, we're talking about a multi-billion-dollar industry in microchips and database management. And then we're talking also about exactly where you first went, which is this drives the small guy out of business. And it takes the growing local foods and sustainable foods movement that is getting a ton of attention now because of the problems with the industrial food system.
Right.
And it puts us out of business. And when you talk to the industry officials, you see, I combine those, the agency officials and the industry guys, really they're focused on the small guy. I mean, I've heard so many times that it's the backyard poultry that's the disease threat.
That's exactly right.
It's
okay, I'm going to have to take a quick break, but we're going to pick that up when we come back. Can you stick with us, Judith?
Sure.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, we're talking chickens with you. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Well, what do you think? Can we bring chickens home from the factory, or are they a great threat, as the government seems to think? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have Jennifer Majesi with us from Vermont, who is the author of The Joy of Keeping Chickens, and also the resident farmer at the Fat Rooster Farm. Was it really a fat rooster, Jennifer?
Well, actually, it was really a fat rooster. Before I tried foolishly to make a pet out of one of the meat birds that we were raising, and I named him Forrest Gump, and he succumbed early in life, and I wanted posthumously to name our farm after him, and it originally was going to be White Rooster Farm, but my husband and I decided on Fat Rooster Farm.
You know, I was reading a little bit of your blog, and there was a piece in there about how a mama cow strangled her baby calf, and it, you know, I thought back to my time on my grandparents' farm, and it's a lot of living and dying.
Yes, it is. It's a big reality check, this farming business.
Why are you such a threat to the government?
I guess I don't fit the mold. I want to be self-sufficient. I want to make sure that
Is that what the problem is?
It could be.
That you're self-sufficient. Judith, what do you think? Is it self-sufficiency that frightens the government so?
I think that's part of it. I think they're worried, and not just the government, but when you look at it from industry's perspective, if people not just are self-sufficient in terms of growing their own food, but if we decentralize the food supply and people buy it from their neighbors and buy it from the farm down the road, then there's the potential to just, frankly, destroy the current industrial food system.
Yeah, and I absolutely think it's the industry that's scared of me, not necessarily the government per se.
Okay, so when the government goes to make its decisions, you know, the interesting thing about H.R. 875 is that it makes a provision in there for bringing in industry leaders to determine the protocols for how things should be done. Well, Jennifer, are they going to call on you?
I doubt it. I don't think that they're going to trust me to make the decisions they want on the table, no.
So they're going to call on those who have the economies of scale sufficient to donate liberally to campaigns, political campaigns. Okay, so that's not you, is it?
No, and I think that's very intimidating. If you know, like one of the people who was responding to your post said that it just seemed too overwhelming to think of if you look at the large picture. And I think the small guy doesn't look at the large picture. The small guy looks at growing an heirloom tomato, saving its seed, and being able to perpetuate those plants the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a much smaller scale of economy. I think it's a more sustainable one.
And yet you're such a threat. Judith, are you a threat too?
Oh, absolutely. I've been told by our state vet that, you know, it was the backyard poultry that caused the avian flu outbreak here in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, completely contradicted by his own documents.
Sure. And it always seems to me that the real problem here comes in not from backyard or local farmers. It always seems to be an issue of the processing and the packaging and the distance, the great distances from where food is grown to where food is consumed. And always seems to be the farther away you are from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in that food. If I were Jennifer's neighbor and buying her eggs, I would have a tremendous amount of control over those eggs. Would I not, Jennifer?
Absolutely. The neighbor actually writes, she comes in, takes them out of the nest box and writes it on the chalkboard that she's taken it. And then in exchange, we barter babysitting services. So there's that whole other threat, is this whole sense of communicating with neighbors, and actual green dollars are not exchanging.
Okay, we're going to run to the phones. We have a whole bunch of people that want to talk in a very little time. So hang on. Here we go. Jerry on the cell phone. Jerry, are you there?
This is Terry.
Terry. Go ahead, Terry.
Hey, Michael. I work with 4-H kids, and I'm a poultry leader. I've been a poultry leader for almost 30 years. And nothing is quite as wonderful as a little kid raising chickens and having a little hen sit on eggs and have a dozen little fluffy chicks come out and then having the opportunity to raise those up. And with that national animal identification system, that will disappear, or those kids will become lawbreakers.
Wouldn't you feel a lot safer with the government watching over you, Jerry?
Oh, yeah, so much safer. And having them the option of intruding upon my property anytime they feel like it to make sure my chickens aren't sick. It's just another Big Brother thing, and it's very scary. That everything is, you know, how do they say the road is paved with good intentions or
good
something
intentions.
Along that line?
The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Well, that's exactly it, and that it's very, very sad. You know, every law that gets written on the book just about has a basis in something that seems worthwhile, but it's the ripple effect that what it does down the road is with services.
Okay.
And, you know, our county fairs with the poultry shows, and that's just poultry. I mean, the NIIS is all livestock.
It's everything. It's Jennifer's entire farm.
Thanks for
the call, Jerry.
I absolutely agree with him that the day they outlawed chickens.
Hold on for just a second. Okay, try it again. Are you there, Jennifer?
Yes, I am. I agree that the day they outlaw chickens is the day that outlaws will keep chickens.
Okay, folks, we have a few minutes, and we have a lot of you, so we're going to come right back to the phones. Please do stay tuned. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with Jennifer Majesi, author of The Joy of Keeping Chickens and proprietor with her family of Vermont's Fat Rooster Farm. Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, what do you think? Can we bring our chickens home from the factories again, or are we forever to be condemned to eating those factory-farmed chickens? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Jennifer Majesi, who is the author of The Joy of Keeping Chickens. Gosh, is it possible to bring them home again, Jennifer?
I think it is. I am an optimist. I think that we can do this.
We can do it. Let's go quickly to Ray. Ray, welcome to The Food Chain.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment about H.R. 875.
Mm-hmm.
Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro's husband is one of the major molders and shapers of public opinion. He runs a company that is gigantic. It's worldwide. It not only molds public opinion, but it takes the polls to enforce that the public opinion that they have molded is correct. One of his clients is Monsanto.
There you go.
And you can find more of this information on John Hamill's website, which is IAHF, as in Frank, .com, IAHF.com. And you really should have him on your radio show talking about this.
We have.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful.
Okay.
And I just want to thank your guest. I'd never heard about SIAS before. I'm going to be looking into that one also.
Cool. Thank you very much,
okay.
Ray. Appreciate your
Bye-bye.
Call. Let's go quickly to Tamara. Tamara, are you calling from San Francisco?
Hi.
Hi.
And actually, I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. Just have a Bay Area number.
Oh, okay, good.
I'm a lead poisoning prevention and awareness advocate,
mm-hmm.
and my website, because I have a whole discussion about urban chickens on my website.
Mm-hmm. Which I've looked at, which is I found very interesting. But the point is, what you're trying to get at here is that chickens eat everything, right?
Yeah.
Not aware of what they're eating, they could be eating...
lead. Yeah, and the main thing you just said a bit earlier that, well, if you... get a bad egg from your neighbor, you're going to know what that egg, you know, if that egg is bad, and everyone's going to know. But if you get a lead-poisoned egg from your neighbor, you're not going to know. And the problem, for example, in an urban environment like Portland, Oregon, is 85% of the homes either have been painted or are currently painted with lead paint that's now deteriorating from 100 years ago or 80 years ago. And when people had urban chickens 100 years ago, that paint wasn't deteriorating. It wasn't in the soil, and the chickens weren't eating it. And now they're eating the lead, and they're going to gravitate.
The point is, if you have chickens, you have to be aware of what they're eating.
Exactly.
That's true. You
have to have your soil tested.
Very good. Thank you very much, Tamara, for that call. Really appreciate it. And we have time for Rich. Rich, welcome to the food chain.
Yes, hi, Michael. Remember the big fish eating the little fish? It's easier to control and tie money into it, and they get our money, they control our lives, and ultimately population control.
Mm-hmm.
Control the food.
There you go. Thank you very much for that call, Rich. Jennifer, I hope you're right. I hope we can bring chickens home from the factory because I remember what they tasted like. I remember the eggs. I remember the chickens. I remember the joy of keeping chickens. And it's so nice to have you to help remind all of us. And you do have a wonderful book. So if anybody out there is interested in chickens, The Joy of Keeping Chickens by Jennifer Majesi.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
You bet. And hey, thank you all for tuning in. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio. And remember, cheap food isn't. Thank you all.
Listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.